This Saturday, the Gilmore International Keyboard Festival will introduce one of its Gilmore Young Artists of 2014 to West Michigan. 19-year-old Andrew Sue will play a solo program in Stetson Chapel on the campus of Kalamazoo College. Originally from California, he became a student at the Curtis Institute at the age of just 14, recently graduating with honors in piano performance, at which point he turned right around and rejoined the student body at Curtis as a composition student. When Andrew Sue and I were corresponding via email to set up a time to chat, I noticed there was a phrase in German, a tag at the end of his emails. He told me it was a quote from Goethe that says, "A useless life is an early death."
From where I'm from, and certainly my family culture, we prize industriousness and sort of working towards something. Always, hands are never idle, that we're always doing something. And that's something that I very much admire and strive to do, that, you know, my hands are always doing something, always thinking about something, always striving for something. Never am I just sitting and letting things unfold.
Do you have much time for watching television or, you know, doing some of the typical time-wasting stuff we all tend to do?
Well, I do watch the news from time to time. My dad mostly watches it. I used to pick things up from Twitter and the internet, but I watch the news from time to time and I want to see something. I watch the Olympics. But I find myself mostly working. You know, whether it's writing, practicing, sometimes I, you know, socialize, I go out, I'm with friends, but, you know, I will always try to get one new thing done. Not just something done, but one new thing done every day.
Is it sort of like an itch? Like if you're in the middle of a boring conversation or something and the back of your mind starts saying, ooh, you should work on this one passage, or what if you added this to the next piece?
It's something called multitasking. I wouldn't call it an itch. I think I'm just so used to it. It's how I've lived my life, all 19 glorious years of it. But, you know, I could go to a retreat for a couple of months and sort of sever myself from the working life, busy life, and sort of just de-stress. But then after a while, after a couple of months in, the urge starts, like, I need to do something. I guess it's just, I'm just so used to it, just to, you know, to working.
Do you surround yourself with people that tend to work in the same way, or do you have a wide variety of acquaintances?
I have a wide variety of acquaintances, I think. I mean, I'm flexible. I mean, I can, you know, take the evening off and, you know, relax and watch TV, talk with friends, do all those things. But especially in my line of work as a pianist and also composing as a composer, a lot of it is alone and just sort of being able to be dedicated to being alone with yourself and dealing with yourself, which is another story entirely.
You must compose at the piano.
Not always, actually. I compose, of course, when I write for piano, I compose at the piano. It's really natural. I write vocal music at the piano, too. But often, a lot of instrumental music I write away. I mean, I pride myself that I think I can at least imagine my music or imagine the music, what a score would sound like just by looking at it. But a lot of times, you know, when you're writing for, say, a string quartet, writing at the piano for me becomes more of a limitation because then you are more prone to write something that's pianistic rather than that's suitable for strings. And for me, it's easier to conceive of that in my head. After I write something, if I want to make sure I know what it sounds like, I'll sit on the piano and I'll hack through it. But I think I do most of the, you know, conceiving of the work in my head.
You recently graduated from the Curtis Institute.
Correct.
I'd love it if you gave us a little overview of those years and your growth there.
So it was the March of 08 when I auditioned. I was 13, so I was still a kid, an obnoxious kid, but a kid. And I auditioned, and I got in, thankfully and wonderfully and miraculously. So I entered Curtis September of 08 as a 14-year-old kid with a chip on my shoulder. And, you know, the thing about Curtis is that it's quite unlike any other place in the world, that it's so accommodating to any kind of person. And how the school is run is that it's run, you know, like a family, you know, with a lot of the faculty, the head of their sort of respective studio, you know, sub-families. And, you know, everyone treats each other like a brother or sister, or sort of we help each other. We sort of help each other grow. We help each other point each other's mistakes and also support each other and whatever we do. They always often say that always remember your Curtis friends, because you go to any city in the world, there's going to be one or two that you've known from your Curtis years, or a graduate of Curtis. And there's something about that kind of bond that you form at school that sort of stays with you for the rest of your life, your musical life at least. And I mean, that was one of the greatest things that could ever happen to me. And, you know, I matured as a person, as a musician, a composer. I was already composing and playing, of course, before I came to Curtis. I was a piano major. I took composition on the side with a major faculty. So I did get possibly the best education there is. So I did that for 5 years. I was active. I was always active at school. I had many friends, so I did lots of chamber music. I did many different activities. I played in orchestra. I played with orchestra. I wrote a lot of music for a variety of different ensembles, and, you know, so I definitely very, very productive. And that was 5 years, and I, which is perfectly normal for a lot of Curtis students. We have a saying that graduating from Curtis on time is like leaving a party at 10:30. because the place is too good to be true. I mean, in addition to it being free, which I don't even have to mention that, but yeah. The atmosphere is still wonderful there. So I stayed for 5 years. I got my bachelor's. And then I re-auditioned to be a composition major, which gave me some other benefits, which, you know, I had to perform an orchestral premiere every year and a large chamber work premiere every year, at least, yeah. Plus a multitude of side projects, workshops with the school, and the ability that, you know, that the school commissions us occasionally to write small works for students who request. So I've just been more active on the composition side. I was still active as a pianist. I mean, I didn't do as much because I wasn't a major anymore. I decided I'd get some opportunities to the actual majors. But I have a trio, my beloved trio, which we still play together. So I'm wrapping up my first year as a composition major. I'm staying for one more year, and then it's on to the next chapter.
Hey. Composers, I think like Beethoven, they had a lot of pieces written under their belts and very accomplished pieces written before they agreed to assign the Opus 1 number. I don't know if that's true today, but I wondered if you had a lot of sort of juvenilia and then one piece that you said, this is the one I've achieved, the kind of mature piece I want to be represented by with like an Opus 1.
That's always a very interesting question. You know, Bartok did that four times. Bartok had three sets of Opus numbers, and then the fourth set, he did away with it completely and decided, I'm not even going to try anymore. So, I mean, composers, they go through their own phases. And for sure, for Stravinsky, who never gave any Opus numbers, you know, when he wrote Pulcinella and the early neoclassic work, I mean, it had to be of a completely different, you know, series. Yes, you could say, you know, it all is one linear sort of work. And Bartok's output is today classified usually by, you know, third-party people who organized his works into a single chronological order, as opposed to his actually very, very confusing three sets of Opus numbers. I don't know. I feel I'm still young as a composer, for sure, and I'm still exploring a lot. I don't know. I definitely have works that I find that are too immature, that, you know, I try not to have done. and a set of works, more recent works that I find are mature enough that represent me. But I don't know, maybe 5 years from now, I might have an epiphany and, you know, do away with everything I wrote in my school years and, you know, start a completely different set. You know, we leave that to fate as a composer.
Well, I may just have to save that question for 5 years from now and you're back at the Gilmore Festival and I can ask it again.
Perhaps. But one thing that is for sure is that I'm constantly maturing, and every composer is.
Mm-hmm.
And that we are being, the nature of our work is to be self-critical. And naturally, we will be much more inclined to favor our more recent work than work in the past. And that's just always how it is. I actually just walked, Joan Towner was here the other day, and I just walked with her to in Pennsylvania. We walked to 30th Street Station together. We were both taking a train in New York. And she made a very interesting point. Me and another composer colleague, Riho Maimet. The three of us were just talking about growth as a composer. And, you know, how do you balance, you know, there's one thing to teach a young student good style. And there's another thing to let the young composer develop his or her own sense of style. So how do you balance the two? You don't want to let that person's juvenile style, you know, the young composer doesn't know what works, what doesn't work. But you don't want to also stifle what they think. And, you know, she made a good point that, yes, a composer's greatest critic is himself, but his biggest teacher is also himself. The best way and the only way for a composer to truly learn is to hear his or her music played by other people. That way, you get the feedback from other people on the how idiomatic it is and just how it sounds. So I do think it's very, very important to hear what other people have to say. I mean, whether it's your coach or teacher or players that are playing your work, and also just to experience it yourself. It's being self-critical is one thing, but if you're always self-critical, you never get out of your head. Music is to be played for other people, not just for your head.
Well, that is perfect, because we here in Kalamazoo and West Michigan are going to have the opportunity to hear you play for us during the Gilmore Festival on several occasions. You're going to be playing a solo recital on April 26th at 2 p.m. in Stetson Chapel, the following day at 4 p.m. in the Vicksburg Performing Arts Center, and Wednesday, May 7th in Grand Rapids at Kretschmer Recital Hall. And in addition to that, two concerto performances, Wednesday, April 30th with the Lansing Symphony Orchestra, and then Saturday, May 3rd at Kellogg Auditorium in Battle Creek with the Battle Creek Symphony. And the work you'll be playing is a wonderful romantic concerto, Robert Schumann's Piano Concerto in A minor. So how long has that piece been in your repertoire?
I learned the piece a while ago when I was younger. It was a favorite piece as a kid. And I learned it, I performed it with the orchestra. And then, you know, I moved on and I learned other pieces. And I just came back to it for these performances and picking it up again and sort of revisiting the piece. So, I mean, I guess I've had it for a while, but in a way, not really. Because I feel when I played it when I was younger, I was a very different musician, very different pianist. And it's a matter of reconciling my memory of playing the piece and also with what I'm doing now.
I saw that you'd won an award for your songs with text by Dickinson and Schumann, of course. Mm-hmm. Was he possibly one of the composers you had some experience studying his songs as well?
Yes, I would primarily call myself a vocal composer. I say that with intense reservations, of course, because I do love writing instrumental music as well. But there's something about writing vocal music, songs in particular, also choral works as well. That's extremely at home with me. It's funny because I didn't take voice. I did a lot of solfège and singing. I mean, my singing teacher growing up also had me sing in choir, and so I did all those things. But I believe it was in 2011 for the Dickinson song, which something began to click. And Schumann, of course, is one of my heroes. Schumann, Schubert, then of course the great American composers, Roram and Barber, and Wolf, of course. I mean, there's so many great song composers, which, of course, you know, every time I sit down to write a song, a piece for voice and, you know, accompaniment, you know, that legacy is always in my head.
Mm-hmm.
I think Schumann's songs might have been my first love.
Really?
Could have been. I mean, I think he's for sure, no, I studied Schubert first. But there's something about Schumann songs, which Schubert, it's perfect. It's, you know, this, you can't touch it. There's a kind of earthly quality in Schumann songs, I think, that Schubert doesn't quite achieve. I mean, I don't think he's trying to achieve it. But, you know, when Schumann expresses his form of love or yearning or whatever he's feeling at the moment, there's always this sort of earthly Dionysian quality to it, which, you know, which charges the piece, really. And it gives the piece so much driving force, which is, you know, wonderfully effective in the voice.
I don't know if you have you looked at the Gilmore Festival schedule too carefully, but while you're here, Randall Scarlatta and Gil Kalish are going to sing Dichterliebe.
I just did that recently.
Oh.
I just did that. When did I do that? I did that in October, yes. That was actually quite fun. I was experimenting what it was like to play it from memory. So my baritone and I, we did it from memory, and it's an incredible experience, because then the score no longer stands between us. The difficult part then is, you know, suddenly you don't know what's coming next in his voice. You know, you could, with a score, you can look at the score and say, okay, he's singing this on the fourth beat. Okay, I'm going to play this. But no, you suddenly have to listen, and you have to place based on what he's doing if you don't think about what's coming next. So it suddenly becomes a kind of discovery. It really becomes. You're playing, and you discover what's coming next. And, you know, with that kind of wonder in Dichterliebe, especially, I mean, it's really, really effective, I think.
I feel the need to steer us back around to the Gilmore concerto performances, one with the Battle Creek,
yep,
Symphony, one with Lansing, two different conductors, two different nights.
Yep.
It's kind of a nice thing to be able to perform the same concerto, though, in a short, yep, amount of span. It'll be different both nights.
It'd be very different because I'm not sure if every pianist feels this way, but I feel the Schumann concerto especially, there are many, many sections where the piano is just accompanying the orchestra. And the orchestra has a principal voice. So how I was raised, and, you know, when I studied the art of concerto with Mueller, Walter Werner Mueller, who taught conducting at Curtis, you know, the orchestra lead. And in theory, if the conductor is prepared enough, he can accommodate both the soloist and the orchestra. So it would be very interesting. There are many, many sections in the concerto where, you know, not that I'm going to be relying on the conductor, but I'm following the orchestra. So because it's two different orchestras and two different conductors, you know, it will be different. So it will also require a lot of quick thinking on my part.
And it's just like you were talking about in the song cycle, you have this piece memorized, so you can look for those moments and surprises and interactions and take advantage,
yes,
of that.
And for me, that's the essence of all of this. I mean, in the music like Schumann, which is so filled with wonder and sort of always moving in a slightly different direction, changing at every turn, you have to keep that sense of wonder, or else, you know, it becomes stagnant.
Well, let's have a look now at your solo appearances. Recitals on April 26th in Kalamazoo at Stetson Chapel, on the 27th in Vicksburg, and May 7th in Grand Rapids. The pieces you put together for your program, what did you What did you want it to look like overall?
I guess as a composer, I'm a bit biased towards music written in the more recently, shall we say. Now, I always have problems with fellow pianists who decide they don't want to play anything written after 1920, which is music too, and that as even if you know something you might not prefer, you as an artist, it's our job to sort of present the entire scope of music. I mean, if you decide to stop music at 1920, you know, we're not living in the 1920s. We're living in the 21st century. There's an entire century of music that you can't just simply ignore. And of course, then I have problems with the other side, that people who only play music after 1920, which, again, you're just doing the same thing, but the opposite. You're completely forgetting about music written before. So I believe in a balanced program, something that shows elements from across the board. And I guess I tried to achieve that with here. I'm playing two large American sonatas, one far more romantic than the other. Then there's the Chopin, I'm opening with the Chopin Mazurkas, and I'm playing a Mozart sonata, and then I'm playing a new work, a new fantasy. So I'm just sort of picking out small sound worlds from the Mozart sonata to April 4th, 2014.
The two big American sonatas on your program are by Aaron Copland and Samuel Barber. And I know that Samuel Barber is closely associated with the history of the Curtis Institute of Music where you attend.
I first played the sonata, 15, for the Barber Centennial, of course. Mm-hmm. Being a Curtis composer, Curtis had a big thing, and I went on tour with that piece. And I played it at his church that he grew up in. I mean, wonderful experience. So, you know, it was only natural when I got this to bring a part of Curtis with me.
As to the Copland Sonata, we just don't hear this piece that often.
No, it's a shame. I think it's very underplayed. We hear the variations a lot, which is short, probably why it's done. And then also we don't hear the fantasy, the great fantasy, 1957, I believe, which is 35 minutes long. Again, not played. So the sonata occupies a kind of a middle ground. 1941, 25 minutes or so. He doesn't explicitly state it. I believe it's about, I really do think it's about the war. It's a heartfelt, tragic. It's a very, very dark and interesting piece that deserves to be heard, hence I'm playing it.
Well, now I'm actually really curious about what kind of musical language you speak in, what influences, and you know, what part of the tonal spectrum do you fall under, that kind of thing.
Again, I'm a young composer, so I'm constantly searching, and maybe I have to go back in time a little bit. Of course, my earliest pieces, before I even sort of began studying composition seriously, and when I was just at the piano, of course, were in a very sort of Chopin-esque, you know, Hummel, kind of light, filigree, kind of early romantic, late, sort of that kind of idiom that naturally is what, as a pianist, that's what I was used to listening to. Of course, I mentioned my composition teacher, my theory, who eventually became a composition teacher, Pamela Quist, an incredible lady. She was the one who really opened my ears. I was 9, 10 when I went to her. And my first assignment was to write a piece inside the piano, which broke all barriers. And then she began sort of introducing me to music of the 20th century and sort of going through the order. And the first composer that I truly fell in love with, it's hard to believe I'm saying this now, was Weber. Weber and Schoenberg and the Second Viennese School. And so for a couple of years before I came to Curtis, I was a hardcore serial composer. And it's kind of funny because when I came to Curtis, that completely changed. Because at Curtis, you know, people don't play that. You hear Bach and Beethoven, Brahms occasionally, all the time. And I remember I had a big sort of composer study of Shostakovich, and you know that did it with serial music, and I left it for and I began writing briefly in a sort of neo-romantic semi-tonal style, I guess. I don't like that term. And along with that, I picked up jazz. Not that there's much jazz at Curtis, but, you know, I heard little bits of it, and I spent a summer in France, and I participated in all these activities, and I'm no jazz pianist, but, you know, I can certainly imitate it rather well. But that eventually became sort of an integral part of my language, jazz chords and sort of a jazz elan, you know, that kind of improvisatory sort of free style. And so even as I sort of transverse through different studies of different types of music and composers, I feel like this jazz quality is always within me. So it was interesting when I wrote this solo piece, because when I came here, when I came to Curtis, I decided I'm not going to write for solo piano. That's all I did, essentially, before I came. And for me to sort of mature and to expand my interests, I should not write for it and write for other instruments. So this is the first piece in a long time, which a sort of long, big, serious piece I wrote for piano since I was a kid. So it's very interesting. So I guess it was just always in my head, but I began going back to that early Weber and Charles Bournon, Carter, Boulez, that sort of old style that I used to worship so much. But this time, as my teacher puts it, Dr. Ludwig puts it, David Ludwig, he said, he listened to me play through the piece. He said, you know, it sounds like Boulez, and all of a sudden in the middle of it, there's a jazz lick. And so it's from the, I would characterize this piece that I'm going to play, a merge of the two worlds. You know, there's a lot of this sort of fractured, jagged, second Viennese, post-second Viennese style abstract music, but grounded by these, is a kind of really jazz sonority. So it's actually a kind of weird but wonderful mix.
That does sound just intriguing. It'll be really great to hear you perform it on more than one occasion at the Gilmore with your three solo recitals. Before we go, and I'm sorry I forgot to ask this earlier, but I would love to know from your point of view what it was like to find out that you were given the Gilmore Young Artist Award.
Oh, best story. I was in Tanglewood. It was my second day there, I believe. I just got in and I realized I was missing some equipment. So I was with my friend Corbin, and he had a car. So we found it was like a nearby Walmart. And so we decided like we were going to go there and pick up some missing supplies and stuff. So, you know, Tanglewood hadn't officially started yet. So we had time. So we spent the afternoon there. And at one point we decided to split up because I needed I forget, you know, this, he needed that, and there were two different parts of the store, so we split up. And then I get a call from my teacher, Gary Grafman. I was thinking, okay, why is he calling me? So he calls me, and he is in Norway, I believe. He was judging a competition in northern Norway called At the Top of the World. And that's, you know, where he was, the sun never set. And he was calling in the middle of the night when it was bright day, and he was telling me. And then he mentioned that in passing, oh, by the way, you're a Gilmore Young Artist. Which is, you know, I just settled in. I was getting clothes hangers or something, and yeah, I get this new from my teacher. And I had made, of course, made him repeat it. And then he told me to get in touch with Dan Gustin because he was, I think Dan was supposed to call me, but Curtis wouldn't give him out my information naturally. So I gave him my email. And then a couple of days later, Dan actually came to Tanglewood and we met. But it was quite a shocker.
But you found out under the fluorescent lights in a big box warehouse store.
Exactly. And, you know, doing just sort of menial tasks is just a surprise. And then we also found out that one of the judges was worked at the BSO. So, I mean, it just worked perfectly. So I could get to know all these people that were involved and, you know, I mean, it was just a fantastic experience.
Well, that's a great story. I'm really glad that we're going to hear your music and get to know you and maybe start a long association with having you here in Kalamazoo. That would be wonderful.
That would be wonderful.
Thanks a lot, Andrew.